Welcome to another episode of Bowel Sounds, the Pediatric GI Podcast, the official podcast of the North American Society of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, or NASPGHAN. My name's Jason Silverman. I'm a pediatric gastroenterologist at Stollery Children's Hospital in Edmonton, Alberta. And today I am joined by Dr. Tamara Hajat from Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Hey, Tamara.
Hello, Jason.
How you doing?
I'm good. I'm a little, I need to catch up on sleep.
You know, so we are recording this not long after the time change to daylight savings time, and the springtime change is the bane of my existence every single year. That 1 hour makes such a difference.
Yeah, it gets me jet lagged.
Yeah, seriously. I didn't even go anywhere.
I have 1 hour jet lag.
Didn't even go anywhere. So full disclosure, my wife's the one that sets the alarm clock in the morning. And this morning, she turned her alarm off. And I eventually woke up and realized, oh, it is an hour later than I intended to get up this morning, and it still felt early. I was still tired. It's not good. It's not good. And you've got an extra reason to be a little bit off this time of year, right, Tamara?
Yes, because it was changed on March 10th, which is a Saturday, and Ramadan started today, March 11th, and it just changed the sunset time from 6:45 to 7:45. And then we're going to go into 8 and 8:15. And so it's like we're really fasting the same kind of length of time, but it is more of like you are breaking your fast later. And Cincinnati is very weird because it's Eastern time, but the sun sets closer to central time. So all of my siblings break their fast earlier than I do in a weird way.
Sibling rivalry. So bottom line, you know, I'm feeling really tired. You're feeling really tired. But then you also have to put up with being hungry and thirsty and all of that.
Yeah. And then now we're recording after like I ate a big meal. So I have like... So all of the blood is going to my stomach.
So please cut Tamara some slack as she deals with her food coma.
Yeah, big food coma.
But before we get started today, you know, I just want to once again invite all of our listeners to send in your topic suggestions and recommendations. We have had a bunch of topics, both recent topics of discussion on the podcast and upcoming topics or upcoming episodes that were right out of suggestions from our listeners. So keep them coming.
Yeah, we've had a lot of great suggestions.
But today's topic is one that's kind of near and dear to my heart. We're going to talk about a really fascinating and complex area of practice involving a very important population to me, our guest today, and no doubt many of our listeners. And that's the topic of multivisceral transplantation in our intestinal failure population. And so I spend time looking after our intestinal rehab program, and multivisceral transplant sometimes is a consideration for some of these kids. And these cases can be extremely challenging to manage, and they take a really big team to pull off what can be a remarkable intervention, at least for some kids. And so we were really fortunate to have the opportunity to talk about this with Dr. Ruben Quiroz-Tejera.
Yes, and it was a great discussion. Dr. Ruben Quiroz-Tejera is the Chief of Division of Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, and a professor of pediatrics and surgery at the UNMC College of Medicine. He's also a medical director of pediatric liver and intestinal transplantation at UNMC, which makes him a fantastic choice for this episode.
Yeah, I agree. It was a great conversation. Lots to share with our listeners. Without further ado, On to the show.
We did it.
So, Dr. Quiroz-Tejera, thank you so much for joining us on Bowel Sounds.
No, thank you very much. It's a pleasure, Jason, Tamara, to be here with you guys today and share some of our topic that we are going to discuss today.
It's a pleasure to have you.
So we're going to start with one of the questions that our guests tend to find the most challenging. But for our listeners who don't yet know you, how would you describe yourself in one sentence?
Well, I think it's sometimes we have seen that people use two or three sentences sometimes because it's difficult. But I will say I'm a caring human being that just happens to be a doctor. Oh. I try to emphasize more in who I am as a person and my character. And I think that drives me to be a doctor.
That's great. That works.
That's absolutely a perfect description for a doctor, a caring human being.
I think so. Yes.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Kira Stihara, you live in Omaha, Nebraska. So if we would to come and visit, what are some of the recommendations for the places to see, things to do, things to eat, or places to eat? What would you recommend?
I would say, well, obviously, I mean, in Omaha, we feel very proud of the Omaha Zoo. I mean, for some reason, we believe is the number one zoo in the United States. And I know sometimes my friends from San Diego do not appreciate that, but I think it's something that we are really proud of. There's something that has been recently developed is what we call a riverfront. It's in the downtown area. They put together three parks. They haven't finished it yet. It's about probably 3 to 4 years old. But it's a nice a scenic kind of pathway that takes you all the way to the Missouri River shore, and you can do outdoor activities there. Even during the winter, they have stuff to do there. There is a winter ice skating rink, and there's also some outside, you know, presentations, sometimes bands playing and so forth. I like also the fact that in Omaha, even though we are barely a million people, I will say, when you count all the metropolitan areas, that we have a great variety of restaurants. We cuisine from all over the world. We have it from Latin America. We have Thailand food, Mediterranean, Middle Eastern. I mean, it's amazing. In areas close to downtown, the Old Market probably is the older one. There are very nice small restaurants there that very cozy and basically you can spend great time there. And also in the Midtown is a little bit newer, and the Blackstone areas as well. And close to the University of Nebraska. And we also have the University of Nebraska football team, even though we don't do that well. But people like to enjoy during the season to go to Lincoln to watch the games there.
Wow. So if you're visiting Omaha, go to the zoo, eat some great food, walk on the riverfront, and maybe watch a football game.
There we go.
Sounds like a great day.
Sounds like fun. You know, Tamara and I both got our first experience with tailgating and going to a college football game in Columbus last year. So I would do that for sure. It was a lot of fun.
It is fun.
So can we just pivot to our topic today? And I'm really excited about our topic today on multivisceral transplant. But maybe just in general, how did you develop your interest in transplantation more broadly, and then in particular in multivisceral transplantation?
I came to the States. I'm originally from Panama. I came to the States to look for specialized in GI and nutrition. Nutrition was something that was one of the main movers at that time. But I ended up going to UCLA as a fellow, where definitely at that time when I was in the mid to late 90s, we're doing a 40-something liver transplant. And it was a very fairly busy place. But in UCLA also, Dr. Marvin Ament has the home TPN program. And I fell in love with that parental nutrition. This is before we talk about intestinal rehab and all those things. And actually, the neat thing is that Dr. Marvin Ament was the first one to report sending a kid, a newborn actually, back in the 1970s, home on TPN, which you will consider kind of the pioneers in what it is, what we call today the intestinal rehabilitation program. Obviously, with that combination, eventually, you know, with transplant and nutrition TPN, when we start, obviously, start developing interest in multivisceral transplant, how to help those kids with intestinal failure that have TPN complications to become TPN or parenteral nutrition independent.
That's very interesting. And just to kind of start with, actual multivisceral transplantation. When we say multivisceral transplantation, what exactly is being transplanted? Is it always like the stomach and the small intestine, any other abdominal organs? Are there different variations of like the combinations of organs transplanted in a multivisceral transplant?
Well, yes. This is an area that I believe is at time confusing because, centers have different ways to kind of define this. I will simplify by using two kind of ways. One is using UNOS allocations policies, what you really do there. And first, it kind of differentiate between something that we call multi-organ, differentiate that from multi-visceral. The multi-organ transplant, if you follow up the allocations policies by UNOS, it refers to any combination of organ, more than one organ, that excludes the hollow organs, for instance, stomach, small intestine, and colon. Examples or will be like heart, kidney, heart, liver, heart, lungs, and so forth. Then those ones you don't have stomach or intestine or so forth. The multivisceral transplant will include, according to the UNOS policy allocation, would be referred to any combination with small intestine or intestinal transplant. It will be like liver, small intestine will be considered a multivisceral by UNOS definitions, liver, small intestine with pancreas, liver, small intestine with pancreas and kidney also. If you see, all of them are intra-abdominal kind of organs. And then that's those are the ones that UNOS refer to that. The other way it is defined is more about, you know, based upon if the intestine comes alone or based upon the intestinal transplant registry. They talk about an isolated intestinal transplant. They talk about a combined, when you just do liver and an intestinal transplant together, it's considered a combined. It's not a multivisceral per that definition. With or without the pancreas, because the pancreas usually is brought along, not because there's any problem, but more of a technical issues to kind of avoid the biliary reconstruction. And multivisceral will be anything that have the stomach, basically, to simplify. But you have the stomach and also the intestinal, the pancreas. It can be also, if with the liver, that would be the full multivisceral per the registry. And they can have a colon or not. When they talk about the modified multivisceral is the one, interestingly, that do not have the liver, but the stomach, intestine, and other organs. Then that's the definition. It's a little heavy. If you had other different centers, they may give you a different definition. But I think we try to unify it for the registry. For UNOS, is more at location, what they regulate. Because if you think about it, they don't regulate the stomach. They don't regulate as much the colon because you bring them along with organs that are regulated. For instance, the liver is isolated. Liver is done. The isolated small bowel is done. Those do require regulations.
So clear as mud. but I guess I'm going to throw one more term into the mix because I think often, at least from a surgical point of view, people will refer to the multivisceral transplant, or I guess the most common version of multivisceral transplant that we're probably going to be spending most of the time talking about today, they'll refer to that as being en bloc, right? Like as one piece, all of those organs that you just listed are transplanted in one go, as opposed to like you described, like heart, kidney, or heart, liver, where it's maybe concurrent, but they're basically two separate operations happening at the same time in terms of the connections.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, that a lot of the new techniques have been developed to simplify the way you do the transplant from the surgical standpoint.
Right.
Like the numbers of anastomoses, how much reconstruction you have to do of the biliary tree if you don't bring the pancreas along, for instance. That's something that definitely has been kind of pushed by the surgical technique and try to simplify that.
Right. So broadly speaking, with that alphabet soup of surgical approaches that you went through, what pediatric diseases or conditions are potentially treated with multivisceral transplantation? Who is this for?
Usually, I will say for in the pediatric world, obviously in children's intestinal failure with end stage liver disease or significant liver disease, because that's when you will think about doing a liver, a small bowel, the combined. In our center, the liver, pancreas, small bowel. To your point, Jason, you were referring to that doing the transplant in block. No, obviously it will be things that will lead to intestinal failure. That could be surgical reasons like neck, gastrocnemius, intestinal bulbus due to malrotation, intestinal atresia, long segment Hirschsprung, microvillus inclusion disease, which is more of a, you have, there's not impaired in the length of the bowel, but the function of the bowel. And then we start talking about intestinal dysmotility disorders, with Hirschsprung also is part of those. I already mentioned that. Occasionally, you know, the patient have developed chronic renal disease because of the fluid electrolyte balance, chronic dehydration, and things of that nature. And then sometimes you have to bring along the kidney along with the graft. Then just to point out that sometimes that multivisceral includes the kidney. I've seen it a little bit more frequent lately, but I think it's not that many if you look at the overall picture throughout the United States. Something that is done in some centers kind of systematically is the addition of the colon. There are some centers that are doing that in an attempt to prevent some issues that sometimes has been described in the distal graft, like IBD-like problems or things like that, that is believed to be caused by some of that dysbiosis that occurs in due to that. But we don't do it systematically. We add the colon basically with the indication when for some reason there is an absence of the colon because they have been resected totally, something like Hirschsprung, long segment Hirschsprung. Or also when you are left with a native non-functional colon in a hope that you will eventually kind of will not have a long-term an ileostomy, that you can eventually potentially do a takedown and help the patient in that way.
Can I just follow on and ask something I've seen at least rarely, it wouldn't be the most typical indication, but I've seen at least a couple of times where a patient required, an infant typically required a liver transplant, but because of technical issues with size or anatomy, with the potential for a biliary reconstruction or vascular reconstruction, a multivisceral transplant with the larger vascular anastomoses was felt to be a better option. Have you seen that in your center where the multivisceral ends up being sort of the route by which you get the liver transplant done?
I have seen it in instances where you have extensive thrombosis, you know, like sometimes when you get that extensive thrombosis post an initial isolated liver transplant or for some other reason. Sometimes I've seen it with that. Not necessarily, let's say if there is patients who have intestinal failure, short bowel, I have not been part of those processes, but I understand, you know, sometimes you have to figure out what is the best solution for your patient.
Right. No, yeah. I think that makes sense.
So I heard you kind of mention a lot of situations where a person or a patient would qualify for a multivisceral transplant. And obviously not all short gut patients need it, not all intestinal failure patients need it. How do you determine the eligibility of a pediatric patient for a multivisceral transplant? And what are the criteria for determining that eligibility?
Yes, I think more and more we understand that if you remain without complications from the use of TPN, you can really have a long-term TPN or parenteral nutrition. I'm sorry to keep on referring to TPN. It's an old terminology I learned back in UCLA. And some people tell me, well, TPN is not total because sometimes you have some enteral going. But anyhow, just for the clarification, it's parenteral nutrition. We use it in that way. But we understand now you can have a newborn that you have remained without complications because we will talk about that, but without complications because of all the advancement that we have had, then you really want to ensure that the patient have developed things that will kind of really be a pressing issue, you know, as far as morbidity and mortality. Things like end-stage liver disease is important in the equation. I mean, sometimes it's a little bit kind of, if you think about the fact that sometimes you have to wait for another organ to fail, you already have intestinal failure, then you have to wait for liver failure. But I think if we have a better survival, we will have those discussions, because the problem is the survival that we have in intestinal transplant. But that's one thing. The other thing would be like thrombosis of central axis. You know, we talk about the 2 out of 4 upper central axis. We don't take the femoral axis into consideration for this, and I will explain a little bit of why. Obviously, remember, each side have an internal jugular axis and the subclavian vein axis that you can get into. You can get to the close to the right atrium when you want to be, up to the liver, parenteral nutrition. And also, the last one probably, I mean, the big ones are the infections related to the central venous catheter. You know, 2, 3, some of them, usually life-threatening infections. When the patient went to the ICU in a year or so, then those are things that start pressing you to do that. Contraindications, I will say, just the usual that you will have for any other organ transplantation, systemic disease or progressive disease, degenerative diseases, and things like that. And I think one challenge that we have is because of the nature of the intestinal failure. You know, these kids were premature, the kids have chronic illnesses. Sometimes you have instances where there are some ethical discussions that needs to happen in regard to the severely developmentally disabled child that has some. Then you have to have those conversations. Not necessarily a contraindication, but I think it's something that you have. I want to point out it's important the concept about the upper axis during multivisceral transplantation. It's important to have that. You know, really, when you start struggling with thrombosis, you have to keep in mind that if you are going to do a multivisceral transplant that includes the liver, there is a phase during the transplant process where you clamp the IVC. And during that, that's right before the anhepatic stage that we call in transplant. And that process about 50% decrease in the venous return. And you have to have that access to push volume in the upper axis. Just to remember that, because sometimes we wait too long, like there are 3 or 4, and you have to be drilling through the central vein to kind of put a line and things of that nature, that we have all those things today. But I think we have to keep that in mind. I just, one of the things I want to point out, potentially as a pearl for the audience.
I think that's a really, really great point that you made, because I think when you mention about the loss of central vascular access sites, people always think about the femoral lines as being two of the primary access points. And if you have only lost, you know, 2 upper sites, you still have 2 more plus 2 femoral sites, you say, okay, no, the child's doing okay. They have 4 sites. But I think you make a really important point that we have to also consider what might need to happen in the way of a multivisceral transplant and the potential negative impacts of that.
Yeah. And unfortunately, yes, there have been reports of, you know, ischemic injury to the brain and things of that nature when that was not established.
So to follow up on that, how many sites of access loss would you say would have to happen for people to consider referral for multivisceral transplant? Because you don't want them to lose all access, right?
Yeah, exactly. Then I would say 2, if you consider, usually happens in one side most frequently, is on one side that you get the internal jugular, the subclavian, but it can be sometimes in one side is the internal jugular, on the other side is the subclavian. Those kind of situations, I think you should consider at least in a referral and close monitoring of what is happening. Our interventional radiologist colleagues has become very, very creative about ways of placing lines in these kind of situations. But when you start doing those things, I think you have to really already, that patient should have been in a transplant. Or where you're thinking about, oh, next time we may have to do a transhepatic. It's probably a little bit too late then, I will say. At least to hook up with a multivisceral transplant program and try to decide, you know, where the patient is. Is the patient close to being TPN or parental nutrition independent, then you may take a little bit of a risk. But if the patient's far, like let's say you're still delivering 85, 90% calories through parental nutrition, probably you should be thinking versus if it's 20%, 25%, can you do something else to kind of do that? But I think that having those conversations with already a referral or a multivisceral center already involved is probably the more, is a advisable thing to do on my end.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, if we're specifically talking about the patients with intestinal failure, and we're going to talk maybe a little bit more about this, but there's obviously been significant changes, improvements in care for children with intestinal failure over even the last, 10 years since I was training in fellowship. And more there can be questions about, do you really need a multivisceral versus an isolated small intestinal graft? And I'm sure these questions start coming up more and more. What are the considerations for choosing to go the route of a multivisceral transplant versus an isolated small bowel transplant?
Yeah, I think in short, the isolated small bowel transplant probably will be in those patients that you don't have significant liver disease versus multivisceral probably in the ones that you have significant liver disease. I will say that we have been doing a little bit more isolated because of, as far as the complication, we have some understanding of infection, how to control that, and better understanding of how to protect liver disease. Then sometimes we run into access issues, and then the patient does not have liver disease, or significant, I should say, liver disease, that will grant to do or perform a liver transplant. Then I think if you are running into those situations, or someone that keep on having infections, and would you put, rather than multivisceral, if the patient have not developed liver disease, would you do an isolated intestinal transplant? Those are situations that we have ended doing an isolated transplant because of those situations where you have some other pressing issues, but your liver is not quite injured or you don't have evidence of significant failure,
right,
or chronic failure.
Can I throw out there just... this is maybe the 201 question, like the beyond the basics question, but how about the consideration for potential immunogenic benefit of having the donor liver along with the donor intestine, and the argument that maybe it's actually a better graft from that point of view? Is that something that's still discussed? Is that something that's still a relevant conversation?
It is. I think... the ure is not quite well defined. I mean, if you practice in multi-organ or multivisceral, I'm sorry to say, if you practice in multivisceral transplant, you tend to see a benefit by adding the liver coming along, to put it in that way. Same happens. That's why you say a little bit of multi-organ. Also, same. There are some of those principles. Also, if you have a liver kidney transplant versus just a kidney, there's all some data suggesting that there's a benefit there. When you look at the mortality, there's initially quite some trends toward that. When you look at 1 year from patients that have been transplanted more recently, you have like 79% graft survival probably. Versus 70% with the liver versus 70% without the liver. Then you see a little bit of that trend. Definitely, those are conversations that we have. Unfortunately, when you look at more longer data, you start losing that benefit. And it may even almost even shift in the different way. But I think it has to do also with how, over the past 10 years, we haven't had a lot of changes. But I think how the field have moved also impact, the patients are transplanted today are not the same as the patients that were transplanted 10 years ago or so, or 15 years ago.
For sure. And I want to ask a follow-up question on that. Actually, a couple of questions. First of all, have you noticed any difference in recovery from the multivisceral versus the isolated small bowel? And do surgeons prefer one over the other in terms of techniques or technical difficulties?
I think as far as the technical part, I think they feel that it is about the same. I will say that's when I talk. Obviously, I'm not a surgeon, but that's when I have conversation with my surgeons and my colleagues. As far as recovery, We don't notice a big difference at times. Obviously, I will say that the volumes isolated are smaller than the volumes of multivisceral. Therefore, obviously, is perhaps not a fair comparison yet. We have to probably gather more information. I think as far as isolated intestinal transplant, I mean, we perform, probably a total of an average of a couple a year or something like mm-hmm. that versus what we do for liver. But I think in general, I think the recovery is about the same from the technical standpoint. Some of them may stay longer, some of them may stay large time. But the issue, as Jason mentioned it before, the immunogenesis part of the conversation is that, you are putting an organ, intestine has, a lot of white blood cells, and that will cause a bidirectional, host-donor interaction that will lead to antibody formations and things of that nature that could make more difficult one second time around. Sometimes we tend to do an isolated intestinal transplant thinking that, okay, well, if it fails, we do an explant and then the patient just go back on TPN. That's a kind of a simplistic way to see it. But you have to figure out what happened in the immune system of the host now. Then now you have to probably the second time around, you have to come a little bit harder on the immune system. Because you may be more prone to rejections and things of that, or immune-mediated problems because of that. That's kind of the concept going back and forth. Unfortunately, we don't have evidence out there to define that in a much better scientific way.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it is, you've mentioned that there hasn't been a large number of multivisceral and small intestinal transplants per year. And it's possibly because in the past, maybe 10 to 20 years, there has been changes and improvement in managing patients with intestinal failure or in intestinal rehabilitation, such as attention to line care, GLP-2 analogs, alternate lipid formulations. All of that had led to a huge improvement in outcomes in children that are on long-term parenteral nutrition. What changes have you seen in the landscapes of referrals for multivisceral transplants in terms of the volumes of referrals, and at what stage do you get referrals?
Those are excellent points and comments. I will say, overall, the intestinal rehabilitation programs are running out of business, the multivisceral transplant. And that's a nice thing to see. I mean, to be quite honest, it's a beautiful thing to see. Definitely have decreased the volume of transplant, and that includes the intestine as graph in children's. I think what you pointed out, the better understanding of how to prevent liver disease, the things that we need to do, the lipid formulations that you already mentioned has had impacted that. The infections also, we have greatly impacted that with different techniques of locks, different locks and, alcohol, antibiotics, you name it. I mean, we have all these different things that we have been learning more and more about preventing that. Just to give you an idea, if you think about this, in around 15 years ago, like 2010 or so, or in that time, we were doing around 100 children. Under children were having an intestinal transplant. Most of them, the large majority, multivisceral transplant, basically, at that time because of intestinal failure and the complication from parenteral nutrition. By just 2022 is the number that I have right now. We went all the way down to 22 children were transplanted in the whole United States.
Wow.
And that's huge change. Yeah. And for the first time now, we are seeing adults. This small bowel transplant was a pediatric thing for many, many years at the very beginning, for the first decade or so. And now you are seeing the shift, like more adults are getting transplanted, which is kind of an interesting, and not like the volume of adults is increasing, it's just because of how much the the volume of kids have decreased. That's why it happens. There's a slight increase in adults. And some people speculate that some of these, eventually some of these kids that we see today, we're pushing them to be adults that eventually they may require it. But time will tell. But I think it's a good thing. It's a good thing to see.
And the follow-up question to that is, how does the multidisciplinary team approach in pediatric multivisceral transplantation influence the management of these complex patients, particularly in terms of coordinating care between gastroenterologists, surgeons, immunologists, social worker, and other specialists?
No, that's crucial. That's very crucial. I think you have to have the role of the nurse coordinator is the more important one, because she is or he would be the person kind of taking care of all these coordinations that need to happen among the team members. We do rounds, and I think most of the transplant centers will do in the rounds. We rounds all together, the transplant surgeon, the transplant hepatologist, pediatric, the nurse coordinator, the clinical nutritionist. We have the social worker, PharmD, and so forth. All of them are there in the rounds. And this is a real time thing. I mean, there's a lot of complexity, a lot of things happening, and you have one problem and everybody's bringing their different, knowledge about things. Like PharmD will bring it right away. Hey, this thing could be happening because we are using this drug that have this, or the dietitians will come and say, clinical dietitian will come and say, hey, probably we have to increase volumes or decrease fluids. I mean, all that happened in real time. And the same happened for the outpatient clinics. We have not, the team is a little bit, we don't have, we have the nurse coordinator, the PharmD, the dietitian, surgeons, that we'll see some of the surgical patients more recently. We have the transplant pathologist, but we are all there also taking care of that, those things. Real time. It's not like you have to look for someone to try to sort out what is happening. I think that's crucial for the success of a multivisceral transplant program.
For sure. For sure. These are really complex kids, so you need all hands on deck.
Or maybe one person with multiple brains.
good luck finding that person.
That would be cool.
So obviously, just mentioned that these kids are incredibly complex. Multivisceral transplant, which now is happening less frequently than before, is still a very complex procedure, lots of potential risks. What are the most common and or significant perioperative complications and challenges that we encounter when we're managing children following MVT?
I will say that obviously, as in any surgical procedure, you have surgical and medical complications, and some of them are early on versus more like mid to long-term kind of issues. In the surgical complications area, I will say about 10-15% of patients, that may lead to require a exploratory laparotomy in at times after the transplant, like a second trip to the OR, as we call it sometimes. It will be like a bleeding, because there are obviously anastomoses that happen in the vessels, anastomotic leaks from bowel or from, since we do pancreas, we don't have a lot of the biliary leaks that sometimes you get when you don't bring the pancreas along. And obviously thrombosis and also small bowel perforation at times that can lead to fistula and some of those problems. I think that would be more for the surgical and at the beginning, early on. Then comes the medical part that also start early on some of these complications. I think that one of the significant ones that we struggle with is infections, all type of infections, obviously, that because we do require to immunosuppress these kids a little bit more heavily than some other organs. And those infections could be bacterial infections from abscesses or things that happen after intra-abdominal surgery. Obviously, the notorious viral infections, CMV, VV, adenovirus, and so forth, opportunistic infections as well, and fungal infections. Sometimes it can be related to central lines that we have, you know, they are going to be on TPN. The expectation or hope is that most of them will come off. And this, out of the survival, usually most of them, some studies talk about 90% come off TPN. But we are looking at our own data, and soon hopefully we'll be publishing that. But that's something that can be a lead or cause of having infection still. Now is the center line with immunosuppression is a big issue. Translocation from the graft that sometimes is rejecting. I will talk a little bit more about rejection later. And we in our center and some places do is we do a splenectomy that also brings some of its own issues as we know. There's also the issue about transplant lymphoproliferative disorders, disorder, PTLD, that usually is associated with EBV infection. Usually the same thing, the highest incidence is going to be, or higher risk is going to be in the patient that was EBV negative before transplant. But that's definitely another complication that we talk about, and we see it as well in liver transplant. Of course, that's probably a topic more familiar to the audience. Acute rejection, major issue in these children. So I will say it has improved over the years. You know, in the early to mid-90s, it will be 85% of the patient will have rejection, something as high as that. But now we talk about more recently in the 20-50 kind of percent in the last reports that we have. And there's the antibody mediated rejection also that it's a concept that has been maturing more in multivisceral transplant. And it has been something we have kind of maturing, as I say, for the past 10 years. And that led to new forms of treatment like plasmapheresis, IVIGG, rituximab, and things like that. One of the major challenge we have in transplant is that we don't have markers. No, we don't have markers to, like we do for in liver transplant, even though it's not perfect, but you have the liver enzymes. Usually you don't have something that may increase in the blood that before you are able to diagnose or suspect that the patient having transplant. By the time you know it, probably is ongoing already and so forth. That's something that I have been hoping that we figured out a way to do that. Endoscopy is the way to diagnose this. The one thing I want to mention that is interesting that happens in more in intestinal transplant or multivisceral transplant is the graft versus host disease. We have more incidents like that. And this is because the intestine have about 80% of the immune cells. This comes along, obviously, whenever you bring the intestine into the graft. And a large number of lymphocytes are in the Peyer's patches, in the lymph nodes, and the lamina propria, and they come along. And then there's I call it bidirectional exchange, the immune cells, between the host and the donor that could lead to having a little bit more problems with immune-mediated issues, rejection, obviously, and things like graft-versus-host disease. Then my last comment will be about some of the chronic things issues that we are learning now more and more, that patients are surviving a little bit longer, and now we are running into things like chronic renal disease or chronic renal failure because of the long-term immunosuppression and sometimes fluid electrolytes issues or fluid issues, depending upon if you have been struggling with diarrhea or things of that nature that comes with the other one, which is chronic allograft rejection of the intestinal graft. Then that's another thing that we're seeing more and more now. And present with diarrhea, failure to thrive, sometimes it's not that evident. You're struggling, see the kids having looser stools. And there's no way to diagnose that through a mucosal biopsy. Usually you will have to do a full thickness biopsy of the intestine to be able to look at this process because it's in the submucosa. There's obliteration of the vessels in the submucosa, which is interesting because that's what brought us to speculate that maybe a vasculitis process that's leading to fibrosis at that level. And we really need to get a better understanding in that area to how to prevent it. We need to, because now that is impacting, obviously, the long-term survival. It's becoming a little bit of a challenge with these two things.
There's a lot that you shared there. And obviously, one of the major areas is that kind of balancing act between immunosuppression to avoid rejection and GVHD, but on the other hand, avoiding some pretty serious infections and including viruses that may lead to PTLD. And so maybe in broad strokes, can you talk a little bit about both, you know, the approach from a surveillance point of view? You mentioned, for example, endoscopy to diagnose rejection as being one of the tools that we have, and the medical management. You know, how do we make that balance between avoiding both rejection and infection risk?
Oh, that's a huge challenge that we have. Yeah, I think it's that the million-dollar question. I think it's really hard. It's really hard because, as I was mentioning, I mean, there's so many immune cells from the donor that comes with the graft, and they don't seem to go away, you know, like it happens sometimes with other solid organ transplants. And they remain there, and it remains a challenge. And the thing is that you have to immune suppress a little bit more. Like when you look at the TACRO levels that we talk about, like 15 to 20 at the beginning or things of that nature, I mean, you wouldn't even think about that in the liver transplant world. And all the, you have to also use biologics, no? Anti-IL-2, anti-CD25, or anti-thymoglobulin, which also impair the immune system farther, but then you have the rejection. Then we try to be very systematic about, you know, decreasing the level. Do we really need to have this high level? Whenever we have opportunities, develop protocol, this is where we should be in the first 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. If you don't have rejection, please don't keep on doing this kind of level. Let's go to a little lower. The only thing, though, is that the challenge is that the small bowel is an organ that won't forgive you if you neglect rejection. I mean, the liver may forgive you a little bit because of their regenerative, you know, his regenerative capacity, but a small bowel is, that's the kind of the bigger fear. And obviously, as we're doing all this, then you have the problems of infections that comes along with this PTLD, as you mentioned. I mean, those are the things that it is a continuous challenge, but I think you have to intentionally think about, do we really need to be at this level? Always, whenever you review a level, really understand where you are, where the patient is, individualize in the sense of, you know, did this patient have rejection before or no, or things of that nature. But it's a big challenge, though.
Right.
Absolutely. Sure. And you mentioned a lot of possible kind of long-term complications that might happen post-multivisceral transplants. Can you tell us a little bit about what the long-term outcomes and survival rates for these patients, and how is their quality of life? I know these patients kind of come in and out of the hospitals a lot. They miss a lot of major social functions. The medical team becomes their family, or the second family, not their family, but they're like second family. Yeah. So that's kind of mainly what they know. So how does this affect psychosocial and developmental outcomes in these patients?
Yeah, I always refer to, I'm the Uncle Bob that you don't want to see in the Thanksgiving dinner.
Uncle Bob. Does Uncle Bob have good jokes or not?
Yeah, probably sometimes. No, it's really, the quality of life is, and we become family. I will say, to tackle the question about the survival and graft survival, patient survival in the 2022, I think the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network report, OPTN, they talk about the graft survival around 71%, 72%, I think it is something that around that for the patient that has isolated intestinal, and it's a little higher with the liver. I talk a little bit about that. When you bring the liver along, it's about 79, almost 80%. In our center, first year, 1 year survival is about 88%. It's close to that. Then 5 years, you can start seeing the decrease to 52 for intestinal alone versus 61 for liver intestinal. And 10 years, you start going even farther down. But this data is a little bit for obviously patients done in the 2012, 2014, but that's about 40% and keep on going down when you look at patients with transplant before that. But you could argue that some of that could be techniques and so other things that that you start getting to those times where there was not as much bands as we had from the 90s. I think that that's important to keep in mind, because this is not as great of a survival or grass survival or patient survival. And it's quite at the bottom, probably just a little bit better than lung transplant. But if you look at kidney and liver, it's far from what it will be ideal to be. Then that's one of the biggest challenge when we assess a patient with intestinal failure. We must ensure that the likelihood for that patient to be around, as I said, in 5 to 10 years, is truly with the transplant than with the parenteral nutrition. And there's some clear data to help us with that. And that's something we have to do. In regard to the quality of life, unfortunately, you know, always the thing is limited data, I think, in that area for a multivisceral or intestinal transplant. Obviously, all the concerns that you mentioned are well taken. There was one study way back in the early 2000s from our center that looks at 29 patients. And supposedly, the quality scores were similar to HMASH control, but this was just 1 year post-transplant. Then we have to see now, well, you have 5, 10 years, 15 years. Even we have some patients, believe it or not, that have survived 20 years plus from transplant. Obviously, these are, you're talking probably 20%, 25% given, but that's hopefully will improve in the future. But obviously, these were transplants performed 20 something years ago. But those, that's the, unfortunately, we don't have that enough information there. Obviously, these are, you know, patients, because if you think about the psychosocial issues that these patients have, just think about what caused intestinal failure in the first place, like prematurity, you know, all the health disparities, all the issues, social issues that drive to prematurity, that cause prematurity, and also obviously neck and all this chronic illness, as we were mentioning before. Those are going to be important factors that are going to impact this. And we need to really do a better job on that. I don't think I understand there are some groups looking into this. There's some information coming. But what happened is that we don't have large volumes, and the volumes are impacted also, as we were talking at the beginning of the podcast. Then that's something that we have to somehow figure out, because I don't think necessarily we'll go completely away because a transplant or multivisceral transplant, because we are becoming a little bit more bold in regard to who comes out of the NICU. You know, in the past, I remember the kids just have the duodenum and colon. All the conversation were about end of life and things like that. But now we're talking about, oh, no, you can be on TPN, and TPN can last for 20 years and you can get intestinal transplant. Then eventually, I think we will have a little bit of, we'll have some patients, but I don't think, fortunately, it won't be as much as it used to be before.
For sure. And so what I'm hearing is, obviously, the long-term survival currently with available data is not as favorable as the short, like the 1 year or even the 5 year survival data. But that may be a reflection of era for when the transplant took place. And the quality of life data is limited, but that too may hopefully be improving as we learn more, as we're moving forward, even though we're having lower volume of procedures.
And in our center, I mean, we also, you know, the tools that you used to measure quality of life 20 years ago versus the tools that you have now have changed. And our center is involved in efforts to develop tools. We are doing it for intestinal failure that is patient drive. Like we survey the patient, but the patient tell us, what are these things that are important to you? How you can now measure quality from the patient point of view? Obviously, provider point of view, the ideas that I have are how to measure, but now getting the patient's point of view in the equation, I think, is going to be important as well.
For sure. And you mentioned, you know, a couple of times now that for multivisceral transplant, obviously, you know, things have changed in the last 20 years. You know, we like to think we're doing a better job in both in terms of surgical technique and medical management. Can you comment a little bit about what you have seen in the way of changes of either surgical management or medical management that might be contributing to better care, better outcomes over time?
Yeah, I will say when we start thinking about the 90s, when, you know, mid to late 90s, when the first reports about a group of patients surviving these procedures, we have made some changes in how we perform that. These transplanting blocks that we talk a little bit at the beginning, you know, the new techniques that we have. Our technique includes doing partial gastrectomy sometimes with obviously to help the abdominal domain and also the block resection, as we discussed at the beginning. And we bring the pancreas along because of, yeah, we talk about this also, the avoiding biliary reconstruction and potential biliary leaks. I think by changing that, and some centers will have the variations of that, and bringing the colon along and talking about role potentially reducing some issues that happen in the distal graft and so forth. I think those things have helped significantly. The other thing I'd talk a little bit about, like the new inductions, the biologics that we have available nowadays, trying different things. But, you know, I talk about the IL-2, anti-IL-2, anti-CD25, particularly, and anti-thymoglobulin. Probably are kind of the more popular ones, I think, at this point. And but also then the immunosuppression of Prograf, you know, we don't like it, but I think it you know, have its issues, but I think it have greatly helped the overall outcome when you look at that era. Now, when you look at the data presented in the Organ Procurement Transplant Network report, annual report, then you see that when you look at that data, you don't see major changes, I will say, in the last 10 years. Then it seems like we are kind of stuck right now. It's the overall feeling I get from that data. Obviously, we'll have to get a deeper dive on that one. But I think we need to start thinking about, okay, what kind of other things we can do to kind of improve outcomes, because we are not quite where we need to be. Now, the big challenge is going to be, as we were talking, you know, when you start managing lower volumes, is the learning curve maybe, or the way to understand when you push that things are making change and thinking about innovations and innovative approaches or therapies, then to see the impact of that is going to take a little while longer than it used to. But I will say those are the things that I think it definitely have improved, no? Yeah. The overall graft survival and patient survival, if you think about when we started versus where we are today.
Yeah. Sure. And based on your discussion before, maybe another thing to improve is to find numbers to screen for rejection, because we don't have that similar to kind of liver rejection. I wonder if like there's some stool numbers that we can find, like fecal calprotectin or alpha-1 or something like that.
No, that's an excellent point, Tamara. I think we have been trying to in the past. There's unfortunately not a great one, but we have tried like citrulline levels or calprotectin has been looked at, combination of them to try to understand. Sometimes the turnover is not that great,
right?
Depending on where you are. But I think definitely that's an area that we have to make some improvement, because that will help us to recognize problems early on and try to not only prevent a more severe rejection, but also not pounding the patient with immunosuppression. That's a big issue. When you realize the patient is rejecting, then you have to go full blown to immunosuppress the patient, because you understand that there could be a point where there is no way back.
Right.
And it happens sooner than for us that we are more used to liver. It happens sooner with the small bowel that will happen in the liver.
Right. Sure. So what are your thoughts about tissue engineering and regenerative medicine for potential future alternatives to the traditional multivisceral transplantation for pediatric patients?
That's
think we can
great.
Grow some intestines?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
With some TLC and
that would be a little bit of Sun Growth Factor here. Yeah.
A little bit of water, a little bit of sunshine.
Water, some sunshine.
We'll have one of the faculty on call just watering. Yeah.
Coming and check in the growth. No, yeah. Like about 10, 15 years ago, I was so excited because there were all these small animals, big leg models that they have some tissue engineer intestinal mucosa from stem cells and stem cells. And they were some success. I mean, the way that they look, the function and all these different things that they were claiming they have. But there still remain some significant challenges. And I haven't seen a lot of progress, but hopefully, but it, like, you know, they have not been able to really develop those two smooth muscle layers that you have, the longitudinal, the outer muscle, we call it muscle, and then the circular muscle, the inner muscle layer that supports and contract, help to contract the bowel to move food in one direction. And also duplicating what happened inside the lumen, you know, the microbiomas, I should say, that also that has been a kind of a challenge. You know, what is the right way to get that? Because obviously we know microbiome is important. Then it's not only about the intestinal mucosa. I think those have been the greater challenge for that. We are far from, I think, from human applications of that. But you can just hope, no? Everything started like that, because that will be way better than probably transplant or could you just do it, in just for a period of time while the bowel is lengthening and you will adapt and then avoid time on parenteral nutrition overall in the patients that is presenting complications. And hopefully we can get there.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Roll it forward another 10, 15 years, and maybe we'll have a different conversation.
Maybe in the Jetsons era.
Hopefully it will be around and I can talk about it again on this podcast about it.
Sounds great. Us too. So Ruben, this has been a really great conversation. Maybe if I could switch gears just a tiny bit and ask you to consider your career so far. And looking back, what would you say has been the most valuable advice that you've received? And what advice would you have for our listeners?
In regard to advice or something that I receive, when I was kind of going through this this discussion today, I remember someone back in Panama where I'm from talking about, mentioned to me a quote by Louis Pasteur that say, without theory, practice is but routine, born of habit. This quote encouraged me to remain up to date, be involved in research, be involved in education, to avoid developing bad habits. No, it's easy to develop bad habits, not only medicine, but in general. For my clinical practice, I think that's something that was fairly valuable, I think, about that. And thinking about some sort of advice, also, as we have been talking about an area in medicine that there's still a lot to learn and a lot to do. I will say, I mean, we are in an evidence-based medicine kind of era, but we have to remember that evidence-based medicine does not take care of all patients with a given condition, and there are still areas in medicine that we need to improve outcome. Therefore, we still need pathfinders, not only followers to what has been saying, but also people that will challenge. But I think those people will have to think about outside the box. Usually I tell my fellows to do that. However, I always tell them that you must understand what we have in the box to postulate innovative and reasonable approaches to medicine.
I think that's what's really in the box to think outside of the box. Yeah, I love that.
Beyond the happy meal.
Beyond the happy meal. I've heard people say think outside the box, but it's really great to hear somebody say, no, what's in the box to think outside the box. That's great. So it's been great to have you, Ruben. And this was a very great discussion. We learned a lot. To summarize, what are the three main points that you want our listeners to take away from today's episodes?
I will say, I hope this discussion helps our listeners to understand when isolated intestinal transplant and multivisceral transplant are indicated. The second will be understand that transplantation is a trait, not a cure. I think these procedures come with a set of complications, and we need to prevent them as much as possible and recognize and treat them accordingly. I think we have to know that it's not that we are going to cure. I think that's something that we have to make clear to our patients. And the last one is something that whenever I talk about 1-5 10-year survivals, I always remember that in pediatrics, that helps us to assess and understand how we're doing with interventions. Mm-hmm. Yet, what does 10 years mean for a 2-year-old? No, 12 is... Then our main goal should be for a child to reach the average life expectancy, no? Mm-hmm. 70s or plus, no? Being grandpa, mm-hmm. you know, call that. That should be our goal. And therefore, in this current kind of medical environment, to try to get there with these patients, the child that fails to undergo intestinal adaptation, I will say we need to optimize parental nutrition, extend, squeeze as much as possible, and prevent complications to put off transplantation as long as possible. And if we could eliminate transplant, that would be the ultimate goal. But I think, you know, your best chance to reach that point will be if you think about it in that way, keep on going with transplantation, with parental nutrition as long as possible. And if transplantation becomes something that is needed, then you may be at least closer to those 17 years.
So the goal is to prevent transplantation, knowing that transplantation is a trade, not a cure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I think those are great summary points to end on. Rumin, again, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us and teach us so much about multivisceral transplant.
No, thank you both of you, Jason, Tamara, for spending this time with me. I really enjoy sharing this conversation and having these discussions with you guys.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy.
Thank you. Well, that was a great conversation with Dr. Kiros Tejera. We really are grateful that he spent some time with us and walked through such a really complex subject. I think the takeaways are really great. Biggest one being it takes basically a village. It takes a big multidisciplinary team to really ensure that the right kids go forward for this procedure and have the best outcome possible.
Yeah, and maybe we'll be able to grow some intestines in the Jetson era.
Looking forward to the Jetson era.
So if you don't already, be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at BowelSounds and on Facebook at Pediatric GI Podcast for the latest news and updates on upcoming episodes. If you like what you heard and you want to support the podcast, it would really help us if you did one or all of the following things. One, tell one person about the podcast. Two, leave a review on Apple Podcasts to help others discover our podcast. Three, on our Buzzsprout page, there is a link to support the show by making a donation to the NASPGHAN Foundation. You can also get there through www.naspgan.org. And four, maybe buy some Bowel Sounds merch, like a cup, a coffee mug, a shirt, a sweatshirt.
It's extra stylish. They're very stylish.
Yeah. Very, very stylish. The money you donate helps support some of the amazing things the NASPGHAN Foundation is doing, including supporting pediatric GI research and public education programs.
And as always, the discussion, views, and recommendations of this podcast are the sole responsibility of the hosts and guests and are subject to change with advances in the field.
Thank you all for listening.
Bye, everybody.
That's all for now.